Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday morning here in beautiful Colorado, and you are with us on Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Crystal and B. Larson. Yay, Crystalline's back! And
hey.
Redatus. Yeah. Hi, you guys. Crystalline, welcome
Hi.
Back. Good to have you back.
Good morning.
Here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good to be back.
Yes.
Yeah,
and
really
this
good
is
to hear
a show
your voice,
we,
Crystal.
Yeah. We've looked forward to this one. We have on the line with us such a great friend and a person that we all three admire and respect so much. He's a trustee of Urantia Foundation and somebody we've known for many years, Mr. Gard Jameson. Hi, Gard.
How are you, Paula?
So
good.
Good
morning, Gard.
How are you? So sweet to be with you all.
Oh, man. Well, we
you
we
too.
Had your compatriot and your friend Mo, and that was such a great show, and we loved it. We felt like Mo just really, you know, opened up and shared who he is and what, you know, what he loves. And so we wanted to do the same thing with you, and we've all known you for so long. I have to share a memory about Gard. Gard is a remarkable person, and a professor of comparative religions, and my first experience with interfaith was with Gard, and we went to the Parliament of the World's Religions in 1993 in Chicago, and Gard was essentially our fearless leader, and there was quite a few of us there that went there to represent the Urantia book, and Gard was daily there to tell us, you know, what we should go see, and I'll never forget, Gard, you tell me, Paula, you have to go see Swami Satchidananda. He's such an amazing person. And I'll never regret that. That was just what an experience it was to be in his presence. If ever there was somebody in this life that I've met that I felt possessed spiritual gravity, it was Swami Satchidananda. And I remember also you telling me, you have to go hear this presentation by the Sufis. They have such a profound experience with love. I always remember you telling me that. How much I enjoyed going to see their presentation at the Parliament. So Gard has been deeply involved with the Urantia book for many years. And Gard, I'm not going to hog the scene here. I want you to tell us about yourself and, you know, how you came to be where you are right now.
Well, that memory of 1993 is a sweet memory, and it was a special joy to actually work with Peter Lawrence, who you know, and mm-hmm. and to be with Swami Satchidananda, and we had a group of people who actually were intrigued by the idea of creating a peace monument in the Washington Mall, along with all the war monuments, and. Mm. It's sort of an indication of our culture that that idea was flatly rejected by the powers that be in Washington. But what the idea was to have a place where people could come and celebrate peace and the values of peace and have conversations about how we encourage and instill peace within our communities and our nations and on the planet. And Swami Satchidananda was the inspiration for that. And someday that monument, that place will come. And it's just a joy and an honor to be part of that process. You know, my real transformation occurred, well, I should say, I give great thanks to my father. Confucius says you can learn from the positive and the negative. And I live, as you all know, in a place called Las Vegas. And I actually tell people I'm here doing redemption work for my father. My father was notorious here, and he actually is the only one who ever got a ticket for going 25 miles an hour down the Las Vegas Strip. And,
wow.
You all say, well, that's kind of interesting. But it was mitigating circumstances, 2 a.m. in his bathrobe, drunk with a woman in the back who was not my mother.
Oh, wow.
And he was in reverse, and he told the arresting officer the forward gear was not working. was not working, and he had to get to where he was going. And so it was when I was 21 years old that my father invited me to Las Vegas for all the wrong reasons, and I gently declined him. And it was also when I was about 21 that I was putting in fire alarm systems in Pasadena, California, and I was staying at my aunt and uncle's place, and I had just received word that a dear friend, Lee Benjamin, who had been drafted into the Army, was in Vietnam and was on patrol and was walking down a dirt pathway with his patrol and three children with hand grenades in both hands approached his patrol. And there was, the outcome was everybody was killed except for Lee, who lost his leg. And at that moment, I sort of reached out to the universe and said, you know, the rent's pretty high down here. I'm not sure I can pay it anymore. And if there's anybody there, I need to know. And it was at that moment that the great universal law of ask and you shall receive was experienced by myself. And I was filled with an overwhelming flood tide of transcendent love, which brought me to tears of gratitude and tears of aspiration, and that sort of marked my trail ever since, is to begin to learn how to reestablish that quality of loving kindness and compassion, and as the book says, matchless goodwill, and to see how that can translate into community, not only our Urantia community, but also the larger community that we live in. So it was a kind of a monumental milestone in my life.
What had been your family faith tradition or your religion of origin growing up?
Crystal, we were brought up and we were told it would be a good thing for you to go to Sunday school because we hear Sunday school is a good thing to go to.
we've heard.
Yes, we've heard from good sources. And so my parents weren't really particularly religious, but I sort of had this feeling inside of me, this sort of transcendent yearning inside of me, and I always spent time in bookstores and hanging out with interesting people through those books and followed that trail. And it was in 1972, while I was an undergraduate, that I was sitting in a bookstore in Palo Alto, and I was reading Gurdjieff's Fourth Way, and some people came by, and they were talking about this wonderful book and these wonderful teachings about Jesus, and they were starting to talk about periods in his life that I knew wasn't in the Bible. And so, like a good sleuth detective, after they left, I sort of looked up and looked at this white, big white book and opened it up and was amazed by the table of contents and knew this was quite something. So Gurdjieff went back on the shelf and the Urantia book went out the bookstore. And it was when I got back to my dorm room, and a few weeks later a fellow student came up and said, I hear you're interested in religious things. I've just had a religious experience which has sort of transformed my life. Do you have anything that would help me regain that experience? And I immediately pulled the book off the shelf and I gave it to him, and he went off for about a week. And then a week later I heard a knock at the door, and lo and behold, it was Brian Cox, who had come back with the book and looked me straight in the eye and said, do you know what you have here? And I think it was a Saturday morning, and I was a little sleepy-eyed, and I said, no, a book? He said, no, you have a revelation. And that's when the lights went on, and at that point, Brian and I started attending study groups up in Berkeley, which is about an hour away, and got acquainted with the Family of God Foundation, where I spent a good number of years with a good number of people who are still dear friends. And so that sort of, again, set my path in the Urantia community.
Wow. So you were in college then, right?
I was in college, and I was a little confused by the world around me, by the stories of my friend Lee Benjamin and many, many other stories, and and it was religion that brought me back, and specifically Joseph Campbell and mythology and Carl Jung. I was given in 1971 a book called Man and His Symbols by Carl Jung, and that book turned me on my head as I began to realize the golden world of meanings and values that reside within consciousness, and I began to see within those dreams really kind of resilient and splendorous indications of a meaningful universe. And so those two tracks, if you will, the Ranch book and Carl Jung, have sort of been my railway ever since.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a privilege also, because I got to take classes from Joseph Campbell and hear about the great myths and great stories of the planet, and began to realize that we have so much more in common than separates us, and began to realize how silly some of our Western traditions in their sectarian ways are, and began to appreciate that perhaps interfaith was an important track, which was just sort of in its incipient stages in those days.
I need to mention that we have a caller holding, and I don't, you know, we typically like to give you a chance to kind of, you know, talk a little bit and tell us about yourself before we take a caller, but if you don't mind, I can go ahead and put them on now.
Sure.
Okay. Area code 408, you're with us on The Cosmic Citizen.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
I think I bought the book at the same time, from the same store, East West Books, and I go back to the same era. I have known about the Urantia book all these years, and I've been going to recently rejoined a study group here in Santa Cruz, and I had a study group of my own for some time over the hill in the San Jose area, and used to go to some of the meetings up there in the same meeting that you mentioned before with the same people and know the same people. It's just really interesting. Jim Rowland was the book, was the study book leader that I attended in the very beginning, and you probably know him too. So
I remember Jim. He was a great guitarist. Yeah.
Wasn't he? He made the most amazing guitars. So anyway, it was just kind of, I'm so glad that this showed up in my inbox to be able to be a part of the show. And I don't have Skype, so when I called the number, I was going to ask how to listen, and all of a sudden I'm listening to you guys. So if you hang up on me, I won't be able to hear it anymore.
No, we won't hang up on you.
Oh,
what's your name, Colin?
Oh, sorry, it's Dawn. Dawn Hart.
Hi, Dawn. Welcome to the
show. Good morning, Dawn.
Good
morning. I'm just thrilled to be able to hear you tell your story, and I'm really excited to be able to attend study groups again, and yeah, I've been telling people about the Urantia book again. You know, the Urantia book is one of those funny things. Back in the 70s, I was telling everybody, you know, and so many people just weren't ready to hear about it. And mm-hmm. the sad thing is, a lot of the friends that I had, they couldn't handle it, and basically they basically didn't want to be friends because they thought the book was of the devil and all kinds of weird things. And so over time, I became a little bit more quiet about sharing about the book. And I don't know, lately I don't care, so I'm just telling people about it again. Mm. And so I don't know, it doesn't matter to me anymore. And I think it's time, and it's just been such an amazing journey because the book has been translated into so many languages now, and there's just so many countries that get to, you know, be a part of the revelation. And it's been an exciting journey, you know, to pay attention to what's going on. And anyway, I feel like a resurgence in me of wanting to get the word out, and it's kind of an odd little, you know, that little voice inside of us that tells us what to do, which is God, you know, my adjuster, is starting to ring the bell. Okay, it's time again. So,
well, God bless you,
well,
Don.
Great.
You know, it's it's an interesting thing, getting the word out, but I also like to say getting the word in.
Well, that's the most important thing, right? I mean, I really don't think it's been that important to talk about the book, and I don't really tell that many people about it. Not like I'm, you know, on an evangelist-type tour or anything. But, you know, on occasion I'll tell an old friend that I've known forever who didn't even know about the book because I've known him for 30 years, and I'm just sharing it with him now, you know. It's more like that. But but I think it's really far more important to just live the truth and to be in service to others and to try to live the kind of life that Jesus wanted us to live to begin with. And it's not about anything else than just how we live our lives. And I'm just really, really grateful to have this show. And I guess you guys do this on a regular basis? Well,
Every Saturday, okay. Dawn, we're here. And we try to interview Urantia luminaries like Gard and leaders in the Urantia movement, but as well as other people from different perspectives and different faiths even. So thanks for listening.
So I'll just hear from you. I mean, I saw this in my inbox, so each Saturday I will hear about another one, right? Okay, great.
We'll keep sending you the notices. And
you can listen by calling in and just listening without participating in the show, or you can also go online and listen to the show live on Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah.
So I have to have Skype, though, because I don't have Skype.
No, you don't have to have Skype, but you can call in on Skype if you like.
Okay, great. Well, I think it's really interesting that we got the book in the same year in the same bookstore. And that was
It was a wonderful time to be alive. Bless you, Don. Bless you.
Okay, God bless you, and you know, wonderful, wonderful show. Thanks a lot.
Lovely.
You bet.
Thank you.
And, Don, you can keep listening. I'll just put you on hold, and you can listen as long as you like. Okay, so Gard, you know, she brought up some really good points, I think, and I'd love to touch on some of this with you since we have you on the show and you have recently had an experience. I know you to be such a deeply spiritual man and so sincere and so in your heart, just willing, you know, what you said, you know, willing to help humanity however you can. And I know that you were, and by the way, I wanted to mention that the opening song, Francel Gowron, you know, we play Francel a lot. Francel lives very close to Gard in Boulder City, and they collaborate on many wonderful projects. And you two were members of the same church. Do you want to share a little bit about the experience you just had? If you want to, because Don mentioned people saying that the book is of the devil, and the Urantia book, and it's obviously something that Urantia book readers run into a lot, and the difficulty in sharing and being open about it. You know, she mentioned, I'm to the point where I don't care now. I get that, but there's a price to pay, isn't there? There can be quite a price to pay.
There is a price to pay, and, you know, when I teach philosophy at the university, I always remind my students that the really great philosophers were all heretics. Some of them were actually killed along the way, but they were individuals who were as kind as doves, but like lightning when it came to principles.
Yeah.
That's the kind of temperament and attitude that I think is essential in the forward journey. And so it was back in 1994 that I realized it's important to engage our own backyard, our own traditions, and even though there's perhaps misunderstanding. And so I joined the local church here, which is a non-denominational Christian church, and gathered a wonderful group of people who were just dear friends and sweet souls. And through that journey, I was asked to, in a moment where they had lost their minister, to step in and fill that role. And so I was given the title of associate pastor and just had a wonderful experience through that with many and many of these people. But we had a new minister who came on board who was a little more to the right, a little more evangelical, a little more of a literalist, and he put in
a biblical literalist.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a biblical literalist. And mm-hmm. he put in a board of directors who followed that sensitivity. And so it was one day I got a call from the president of the board, and she sat me down and she said, "I was led by the Holy Spirit at 3 a.m. to Google you." Well, that was a unique experience, I'm sure, to be led by the Holy Spirit to Google. And
yeah.
she said she found my connections to the Urantia book, and she said, "I need you to resign." And I said, "Well, a couple things. One, the Urantia book is not antithetical to Christianity. In fact, the Urantia book holds Jesus up as the highest ideal of humanity and divinity. And so that's, for me, where I take my stand. And two, as the president of the board, you actually don't have the authority to ask me to resign. It would take a vote of the church." And I told her, I said, "I think this would be actually a pretty healthy process if the church went through this, to ask the question, what does it mean to be a Christian?"
Mm-hmm.
And we had one of our parishioners who used to say, a wonderful fellow named Bill, said, "This is a big tent, and we let everybody in the big tent who loves Jesus." And
mm-hmm.
so
yeah.
everybody knew about my love for Jesus and about my work in the community. And so it came to a community or a church gathering, and at the church gathering we were allowed to present, and so I shared, if you will, the best and the brightest of what I gleaned from the Urantia book. And it was fascinating because the vote of the board was 8-7 to strip me of my title as associate pastor, and those were the 8 evangelicals that had been brought aboard, and the other
mm-hmm.
7 were dear friends that I had during the years. And then it was interesting because they then put up a second vote, which was, "We want Guard to continue to minister," and it was 15-0 for me to continue to minister at the church. So
they stripped you of your title, but not your responsibility.
Yeah, mm-hmm. so I still have a centering prayer group there every Monday morning,
oh.
and we fill the room, and people are just
blessed.
I've
been there.
Yes.
I've been privileged to be there.
Absolutely.
Myself as well.
Group.
Yeah.
It's a delightful group, and we begin to experience there the joy, as the Urantia book says, is inherent in human existence, and we begin to experience the intimacy that we have with God the Father and God the Mother, and it's just a joyous occasion. And one of my favorite authors, a Quaker, Rufus Jones, who's one of the source authors of the Urantia book, likes to say that churches should be fires of transformation. And that's a little bit of what
there
we're doing
go.
When we get together. Yeah, yeah.
Well, how ironic. You know, Jesus was a minister without a credential, too.
Yeah.
I just have to point that out.
One of your
dear friends is holding, and I know he probably wants to say hello, so, and it's such a treat to have you both on, so I'm going to put him on.
Okay.
Hello, Mo. Welcome to the Cosmic Citizens.
Hello,
good morning,
Mo. Hi, Kirk Davidson.
Hey, buddy, how are you? I
got to
tell everybody on the listening audience, it is probably one of the highest honors and privileges to serve with Mo Siegel as a trustee of your Urantia Foundation. I'm sort of welling up now as I think about it. It's just been such a wonderful and adventurous, I would say. Mo, would you agree? Adventurous experience where we've had ups and we've had downs, and But on the whole, we have been moving forward, and thanks to Mo's leadership, as Richard Keeler likes to say, your ranch foundation has never been doing better.
Well, Gard, it's you. You're moving us forward, and we're all moving forward together. And it's great to serve with you, and you're the dearest brother of my life, and I love you.
Back at you.
Hey, Gard, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
You know, listening to your Christian experience and thinking about the Urantia book's comments that Christianity is the cocoon from which the butterfly will emerge, and that what is most important is the religion of Jesus to be brought to the world, a new revelation of the religion of Jesus. When you look ahead 50, 100 years from now, do you envision that some segment or many segments of the Christian church will embrace the revelation?
Oh, clearly.
Or will it come out of the church just like the Jewish people did not embrace Jesus and therefore Christianity started up? Or is it possible that, like the Mormons or a branch of the Catholics, will take it and run? What do you think for the future?
Well, what's clear to me in my experience, Mo, is that as people begin to open their minds and their hearts through the experience of intimate communion with God, that they begin to have a larger perspective, and with that larger perspective comes an openness to other ways of seeing. And so the first story I always tell in my classroom is of the blind men and the elephant, where each of the blind men had a different perspective because they were touching a different part of the elephant. And the bottom line is each one of them was correct in their assessment, but wrong in denying the assessment of the others. And I think that's what's happening in the interfaith world, is that people are beginning to open up through the process of inner communion and inner realization to a much larger perspective, and the appreciation that to the extent that we affirm our personal experience, we're generally correct, and to the extent that we deny the experience of another, we're generally wrong. And that's the story of philosophy in some. So, yes, absolutely. I think within 40, 50, 60 years, we are already seeing the seeds of a new emergent church within Christianity. People like Marcus Borg are really leading the charge in terms of helping people to reappreciate the life and teachings of Jesus. And it's interesting because in the early 20th century, there was a book called What is Christianity by Adolf von Harnack, which is actually the essence of the Urantia book, the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. And Paul Tillich, one of the great theologians of the 20th century, said he saw boxcar after boxcar after boxcar of this book going across Europe as people were eating it up. Well, what happened was World War I and World War II, the Depression, the Holocaust, the nuclear bombs, and so there was for a moment there a hiccup as people realized how deep our evil is. But I think we will come back to that full appreciation of the reality of God's intimate and transcendent love for each of us. And as we begin to experience that, again, our perspective is elevated. And I want to say one of the things we did at Urantia Foundation that I think helped to transform the culture there is every morning we engage in worship. And we engage for a period of 20 to 30 minutes. And it really changes the texture of our conversation. And we do this in our study group. It changes the texture of the conversation. There's a much higher level of goodwill, and there is actually a greater capacity for the Spirit of Truth and the Holy Spirit to begin speaking through us in that process. So it's really lovely. And Mo, I namaste you. I salute you, and I thank you for being my friend.
I'll
Paula,
second
can
that.
I ask you one more question?
Of course.
And Gard, I didn't quite understand where you went with this, but I want to ask a question about Islam as well. But with the Christianity, I've been wondering, is it going to be emergent Christians, or is it going to be searching Christians that lead the way, or will branches of the actual churches take the book and run with it? Maybe we just don't know. But turning to the question of Islam, I heard a story recently, and I don't want to get into the details because it's too risky for the individual, but a person had downloaded the book, and I don't remember whether it was Pakistan or Afghanistan, and their father turned them into the Taliban, and the person was imprisoned and beat up and escaped. And we've been hearing stories about just a tiny little bit of the Muslim world finding out about the book and reacting very negatively. Could you talk about how you see the bridge between a book that has 850 pages of the life of Jesus and Michael of Nebadon in it, and the winning over of Islam long-term, as the Urantia book says, someday there will be only one religion on the planet, and Jesus said, the words I speak shall someday rule this very world. What do you see as the pathway to peace with Islam, with these teachings?
Well, one of my favorite stories is a story of a friend from Senegal named Moussa. And Moussa and I went to the Parliament of the World Religions in 1999 in South Africa. And there we had the good fortune of meeting Nelson Mandela and sharing the book with him and having some wonderful experiences. But Moussa often likes to say, and he's a Muslim, the further
You're
away from
You're speaking of
Mecca,
Moussa and Daya of Senegal, right?
Yes, I am. And he likes to say that as a Muslim, the further away from Mecca, the easier it is to embrace other faith traditions and the perspectives of Jesus, so on and so forth. And what we know for a fact is that Jesus is greatly honored within the tradition of Islam, as is Moses. And here we are in the Passover. And what we recognize is that these are all brothers. And Musa clearly embodies that idea. And if you look at the teachings of the Sufis, particularly Rumi and Hafiz, you realize a quality of love and transcendent love that really sort of burns away the sectarianism associated with modern-day fundamentalist Islam, as well as Christianity, as well as Judaism. And so what we see are the roots, and Rumi says this very clearly, my religion is love. He doesn't say my religion is Islam or being a Muslim. My religion is love. And as we begin to sort of soak ourselves in the quality of that transcendent love, we begin to see it's not about the labels, right? Lao Tzu says the Tao that can be told is not the Tao. It's not about the names. It's not about the sects. It's about a quality of experience. And that, to me, is why contemplative experience, as my teacher Thomas Keating says, anything less than a contemplative experience is a pathway to suffering. And so what we need to encourage within our community and outside of our community is that contemplative journey with one another and with people that we meet, because that will transform culture. And what we have now in Islam is a culture of suspicion in many ways, but that culture of suspicion is actually our fault. Our fault meaning many kind of European powers dominated Islamic culture for many years, took advantage of Islamic culture. And so what you see in the short term here is a response to that kind of imperialism, and it's understandable.
Kind of a backlash.
It's a backlash, and it's karma. And so what we have to do, it's a waiting game. We have to instill, if you will, that contemplative dimension in our community so that it's attractive to other communities. And we have to encourage others to really take seriously the words of Hafiz, who says, one day I realized that the sun was just a shadow, that a brilliant incandescence has cast the lovely form of the sun. When you are lonely or in darkness, I wish, Hafiz says, I wish I could show you the astonishing light of your own being. And it is that light and love that dwells within each of us, which is the transcendent revelation of the Urantia book. The Urantia book says nothing short of the experience of the Father will do. And he says even to the detriment of our own self-revelatory sensitivities, we want to tell you that the experience of the Father, this is where you should be moving your lives. And if you're not, you're missing the revelation. You're missing the point.
We've had the good fortune of meeting some young emergent Muslims along with the emergent Christians that we've had the good fortune of worshiping and studying with over the last few years. And I think that one of the interesting things about the emergent Christian movement is also happening in small patches within Islam, which is that it's often the children of the most fundamentalist-leaning clerics or parents who, once they have been exposed to higher education and internet communication and just listening to the leading within, they're the ones who sort of begin to start the emergent movements and become more interfaith friendly.
You're absolutely right, Crystalline. I mean, one of my passions is the work that Sue Tennant's doing in India, and I have friends in Pakistan, and we met a Dr. Yokobi when we were in Melbourne. I don't know if you met her, Paula, but a wonderful little lady from Afghanistan who's opened 80 schools for girls. Mm-hmm. And this is heresy, as we know, in the eyes of traditional Islamists, mm-hmm. Islamicists, I would say. And so these are the real heroes and pioneers of our moment, because just as you say, Crystalline, to the extent that these young ladies, and I'm going to say young ladies because there's a sensitivity there that is really open to new perspectives, as they begin to become educated, I think the whole world changes. And what we see from the Urantia book is, and I'm an amateur paleontologist. I've been involved with the Museum of Paleontology for 35 years, and I tell my students I like fossils because I'm becoming one. And but the bottom line is these things take time, and what we need to recognize in our moment is we're the Johnny Appleseeds. We are the ones that should be out there not only planting the book but also planting a quality of love, and not only in our own heart but sharing it with others.
Well, and Jesus didn't go around sharing the his revelation in manuscript form. He wasn't going around, you know, really promoting the more stagnant or dogmatic traditions, even of his own culture. You know, what was dynamic about his teaching was the good news.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Jesus taught the fourth way. And that was the book I was reading when I found the Urantia book. And the fourth way is the recognition that you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, body, and soul. And so we have four prayer traditions in the West. We have four traditions of yoga in the East. And these four traditions speak to the human condition, which is in whatever way we're approaching our what is real or what is meaningful, we have to be doing it with a quality of mind, where we're thinking about it, with a quality of heart, where we're feeling it, with a quality of body, where we're doing it, we're serving, and with a quality of soul, where we are still and we are experiencing the presence of God. We are quieting our minds in such a way that we can begin to attune and listen to that quality of wisdom and compassion that is constantly pouring forth from the heart of the universe.
Before you got on the line with us today, Garth, Andre was sharing something from the Thought Adjuster papers about the qualities of consciousness that are required for connection with the God within or connection with the Holy Spirit. I don't know if you've got that handy, Andre, but
I do.
It sort of parallels the four ways that Gard was just mentioning.
Absolutely, yeah. I'll be glad to read through that. It's from Relations of Adjusters to Individuals, which is paper 110, section 3, and the last subsection, the last few paragraphs. You must not regard cooperation with your adjuster as a particularly conscious process, for it is not. But your motives and your decisions, your faithful determinations, and your supreme desires do constitute real and effective cooperation. You can consciously augment adjuster harmony by 1. Choosing to respond to divine leading, sincerely basing the human life on the highest consciousness of truth, beauty, and goodness, and then coordinating these qualities of divinity through wisdom, worship, faith, and love. 2. loving God and desiring to be like him. Genuine recognition of the divine fatherhood and loving worship of the heavenly parent. 3, loving man and sincerely desiring to serve him. Wholehearted recognition of the brotherhood of man, coupled with an intelligent and wise affection for each of your fellow mortals. 4, joyful acceptance of cosmic citizenship. Honest recognition of your progressive obligations to the Supreme Being. Awareness of the interdependence of evolutionary man and evolving deity. This is the birth of cosmic morality and the dawning realization of universal duty.
What a beautiful, beautiful. Book. I think I'll have to pick up a copy of that book.
So poetic, isn't it?
It is so poetic. So, you know, one of the trails that I've been pursuing in relation to that is we were in Texas and we were invited to view the Texas Medical Center because we're looking at creating one here in Southern Nevada. And there are 52 institutions there, and it's quite an amazing place with places like MD Anderson. And one of the institutions that really drew my attention was the Institute for Spirituality and Healthcare. And they have been operational for about 60 years. And
where in Texas is this?
In Houston at the Texas Medical Center. And I asked them, I said, my wife's an OBGYN. Would you guys mind having a baby? I'm ready to start the institute in Southern Nevada. So we started the Nevada Institute for Spirituality and Health Care. And, you know, one of the struggles we have right now, as we all know as we're listening, is the healthcare issue. Mm-hmm. But what we realize is that healthcare is really symbolic of a deeper issue, a dis-ease, if you will, with being alive, a quality of stress, and a quality of dysfunctionality or narcissism. And what we have suggested and what we are working on at the Institute is the emotional connection between disease and physiology and spirituality. And so we focus on what India Buddhism or Hinduism speaks of as the three poisons, anger, anxiety, and fear. And what I tell people when we do these lectures is that every day most of us unconsciously get up and we put ourselves on the rack. You might know that image of the rack, medieval torture device.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have anxiety stretching us and dislocating us, pulling us toward the future. We have anger stretching and dislocating us and pulling us toward the past. And we have fear, which is the baseline. And all of these things are creating, if you will, higher levels. And neuroscientists like Rick Hansen and Andrew Newberg have been doing great work on this, have been sort of dislocating us physiologically, psychologically, and spiritually. And so it's interesting to ask the question, if we would really be honest with ourselves and look at those emotional states and stop trying to justify them, but to recognize they are qualities of energy, which from an evolutionary standpoint have gotten us to this moment, so we're thankful for them, but they're also qualities of energy that require transformation. And that's what the Urantia book speaks of in terms of psychic circles, where we begin to move from a level of narcissism to a level of selflessness. And when we begin to experience that selflessness, a quality of joy and love and peace. And so again, I tell the story of the elephant, but I also say that this class I'm about to teach you at the university here is a game show. And door number one is anxiety and anger and fear. And door number two is love and joy and peace. And I always ask the DUH question, how many of you want to stay in door number one? And how many of you really would like to live over in door number two? And how many of you really appreciate that door number two is your birthright? Mm. It's your birthright. And if you're not experiencing it, you are missing out on what it means to be a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this quality of transformation, and what you've just shared, Andre, are the conditions for that transformation. It requires a true yearning of soul. It requires, as Buddha says, noble truth number one, that we truly recognize our own suffering, our own qualities of emotional dysfunction, our narcissism, and that we step into a new world, which is that world of worship and out of that world, a world of service to our brothers and sisters. And once you taste that, once you have that flavor in your mouth, there's no turning back. And so that's what will happen, and that's what will burn away the sectarianism of Islam and Judaism and Christianity. That's what will allow people to see a larger vision, a larger elephant. And so that's the excitement. And the Urantia book is kind of the handbook for all that. And it gives us, if you will, the opportunity to sort of see how that works. But one of the things I've appreciated is the Urantia book doesn't quite get far enough, at least it didn't for me, into what it means to be a contemplative. And so Thomas Keating and others, Basil Pennington, have helped me, Hafiz, Rumi, the great saints of India, the great saints of China, have helped me to appreciate what it means to be a contemplative, that we need to take retreats. And so, Paul, as you know, I don't think there's been a fellowship conference since the late 80s that I've not tried to do some kind of pre-conference retreat, encouraging people to that contemplative dimension. And so that's what we need to really bring people to, is the actual experience, that transformation of consciousness, which one day will bring about the family of God.
Yeah, absolutely. Mo is still on with us, by the way, Mo, and I invite you to jump in anytime you like. We have a wonderful study group, as you know, Gard. It's just priceless to me. I mean, Mo and I started a new reader study group, I think, in 1990. And we decided after many years of outreach that we would get people to study group and they would jump in the middle of the Urantia book somewhere like Energy, Mind, and Matter with a proficient group that was going very deep into the subject matter, and they would go glassy-eyed and we'd never see them again.
Yeah.
So we decided we had to do something about that, and we started this Jesus Paper study group, which we both adore, and everybody that goes there seems to just love it dearly. And it is new reader friendly, and that's something I'm very proud of, because, you know, the Urantia book teaches us that the universe doesn't consider us as even possessing knowledge until we show our willingness to share it. And, you know, we can study this thing until, however long, but we have to be willing to open it up and give it
over
to others. Yeah, I was going to say that. I'm glad you said it. And maybe, you know, who knows when that's going to happen. But we've been talking a lot about, you know, lately about just what you just said and how to take it into a much deeper level of our lives. And, you know, this is something I wanted to bring up earlier, because we're talking about the great world at large and how religions can be so intolerant of each other and even hateful of each other in God's name. And I know that pains us all to think that any human being would hate another human being for God's sake, because we know our Father. From having read these wonderful teachings about him, we know his, you know, at least we can begin to grasp his perfect love. And we can begin to grasp his mercy and his tolerance and his patience and his, you know, his love is perfect. Yet even Urantia book readers who should know better can be very intolerant of each other. You know, even differences of interpretation. We see that a lot. And, you know, it's okay for, say, if I were to have the Dalai Lama on the show next week and he was going to tell us all about reincarnation and he believes that he is the reincarnation of the last Dalai Lama and on and on, would we feel like we have to straighten him out? Yet...
Yeah.
If a Urantia book reader says, well, you know, as I interpret it, I really do believe in reincarnation, we feel just hell-bent to straighten that person out. Like, you know, and one thing that I love about the Urantia movement is so far we've never had an official interpretation of these teachings. And I hope and pray we never do, because that's where we start to crystallize and fossilize the truth, put it in an iron band. And my hope is we never do go there. My hope is that we can transcend even our own tendency to be intolerant of each other because of our differing interpretations. And, you know, and that is about the religion of love, and that is about, you know, getting to that very deep place.
I think one of the things that's key to this, and which I hope will launch into a story, maybe, Gard, of how you started to get involved with the interfaith movement personally. But there is this sense that you have to correct what's wrong. You know, that's really a long-held tradition, at least in Western culture. And Jesus didn't teach that way. He taught people about, you know, truth, giving a higher truth that then replaces or edges out the error in our thinking. And that we all come from some kind of background of culture, a family culture or of religious culture or of spiritual experience. And those origins influence us indefinitely, mm-hmm. regardless of what we're reading now or what influence we've had from even the fifth epical revelation. Mm-hmm. And that acceptance of origins is really essential mm-hmm. to getting to know the whole person. And we're also told that the best way to learn to love our fellows is to really get to know them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty simple and it's pretty pragmatic. Again, in the class, I always tell my students, if philosophy is not practical, then throw it in the trash can. And it comes down to, you know, are we, and are those on the listening audience here, are we willing to make every day a divine appointment? Are we willing to say, I'm willing to take 20 minutes in the morning and hopefully 20 minutes in the evening to actually spend time with our Heavenly Father and to listen, to stop, if you will, the flow of our thoughts and our feelings and our emotions and to allow God to speak to us? And that's not an easy language to broker. Silence mm-hmm. is probably the most difficult language we can learn, though we think and we fool ourselves into thinking it's easy. It's a difficult language, so it's an evolutionary process. But if we don't take that time, if we don't make that divine appointment, then again, with respect to this revelation, with respect to what's going on in the planet, we're kind of fooling ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Amen, Gard.
Yeah, Andre, you know that. Yeah,
I do. You taught me centering prayer in '93 at ahead of the Montreal conference, and I want to just say I think this is a perfect opportunity to at least. I mean, you've been a teacher of centering prayer for all that time and a little bit longer, and I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind just taking a few minutes to share the rudiments and just how simple it is for people to bring into their life a very simple technique for starting that dialogue. It doesn't have to continue necessarily with centering prayer if that doesn't work for people, but it has worked for many of us for many, many years as one of the things that we do to be in touch with our Father. And if you'd also speak to that as a possible technique of bringing into our lives worship in contradistinction to prayer, mm-hmm. which I know you've talked extensively about. Mm-hmm. I think that's very, very important for our listeners to hear.
Yeah, thanks, Andre, for the opening there. And again, it's really important. And I, as I read the book in the early years, I read about these words, worship and prayer, but the experience of it. And so it was in the early 80s that I was introduced to Basil Pennington and Thomas Keating's work, who were very kind of upset because a lot of young Catholics were going to India and were going to Japan to learn how to quiet their minds. And they realized that in their own tradition, Christianity, we have this approach. And they repackaged it, called it centering prayer. I actually believe centering prayer is a method which serves the engagement of worship. It's not worship itself, but it's a method that leads to worship. and what it is fundamentally and very simply, so anybody listening could actually start this, is to take 20 minutes to find a quiet place, to open yourself with just a moment of petition or prayer to the Father, to the Mother, and then very gently to either follow your breath or to use a sacred word. My two words are glory be, and to allow that device to bring us back to a sense of God's presence. So if I'm talking to you, Andre, and we're having a lovely conversation, and in walks Paula, and I get distracted because there's Paula, and I haven't seen her for a while, but I was really talking to you, my sacred word is Andre, and Andre very gently brings me back to my focus upon you and upon our relationship. Mm. And so it's that centering word which provides, if you will, a centering device or method which leads to the fullness of our attention in relation to God's presence, which we know in faith God is present at all times within us. And then when during the course of the experience, when we notice that we're drifting, that we're thinking about dinner or we're thinking about somebody, and we notice that we're not with God, just like I mentioned before, we come ever so gently back using that centering device, whether it's a word or it's our breath, or sometimes it's a visualization, but very gently come back to that as our expression of our intention to be present to God's presence and action within. And then what we know is at the end of this, there's a very deep state of rest, which, again, people like Rick Hansen and Buddhist Brain and Andrew Newberg, Why God Won't Go Away, have studied very deeply in the neuroscience. There's a very deep physiological rest, so we want to come out very slowly. And that's when I tell people it's a wonderful time to then begin to pray. And I have what I call the five buckets. The first one is family and friends, and the second one is teachers and students, and the third one is coworkers, which would include the three of you and Mo and those dear people. And the fourth one are the people I'm going to meet today who I don't even know who they are, but I'm looking forward to meeting them, and I'm going to see them at a 7-Eleven, or I'm going to see them on campus, and I will greet them with a quality of goodwill. And the fifth one, and this is the tough one, this is the place where I pray for those with whom there's a quality of tension. And that tension goes both ways. So it's the space of mercy, it's the space of forgiveness, it's the recognition that there are people in our lives with whom there's a quality of tension. And so we pray for those people, and we pray for some emergence of goodwill in that relationship. And so that's a great time to engage in what we call petitionary prayer. So Thomas Keating says there's four levels of prayer: the prayer of the body, which is service, which we all know about, the prayer of the mind, which is going to study group and reading that book and delving into the Supreme and the Thought Adjuster and all those wonderful concepts. And then the prayer of the heart, which is that petitionary prayer, where if I know that Crystalyn is having some physical issues, I'm praying for Crystalyn, and I'm praying for her well-being and hoping that she gets back onto this program and that she's doing well and her family's doing well. Mm-hmm. And then there's the prayer of the soul, which is, be still and know that I am God. Allow yourself to experience the thunder of silence, the golden world within each of us, and to experience the power of compassion and wisdom that emerges in that space. That, to me, is the revelation. And I think people like Thomas Keating and the traditions of India, China, all the traditions of the world actually amplify what we're learning in the Urantia book. And that's why we should be bridge builders and why interfaith is so important. We should be reaching out to those people. And just as Jesus did, to say to those folks in India, you know, that chakra stuff, that is so interesting. You know, those first three chakras, it's all about selfishness and narcissism. But boy, when you get to that heart chakra, you begin to experience a quality of love and a quality of compassion. And isn't that wonderful? And the big problem with Western theology, in my opinion, is that we haven't understood that everything is energy, as Einstein says, and that those first three chakras, the chakra of security and survival, esteem and affection, power and control, those are, if you will, evolutionarily put into us, and they have actually gotten us to this place. And so we're thankful for that energy. And what we say in Western psychology and Western theology is that that's sin and should be repressed. And what dear Dr. Freud taught us is that anything that's repressed will come back to haunt you. And what we see in our politics, what we see in our economics, what we see in our religious institutions is the haunting of those primary instincts. So what we need to do as a community is to embrace those instincts and to bring them to a quality of transformation through our divine appointment, through our contemplative journey.
Yeah.
What we see in some of the experiences of how the Muslim community reacts to the Christian community is a haunting, in a sense, mm-hmm. just in that same way that you said,
mm-hmm.
a haunting of our denial, you know, our refusal to show them some respect.
Well,
it comes to trust.
It comes to trust, right, Paula? And
if you
don't trust, I mean, I have a friend who went into the deepest areas of Afghanistan and was with the Taliban, and they said, "We are letting you in because we trust you." What a simple word. And I just want to share that this is our new value statement at Urantia Foundation, trust. And so if you take the first T, it's teamwork.
Mm-hmm.
If you take the R, it's respect. Respect for every person that we encounter, every reader, mm-hmm. every person on this planet, no matter what their belief system. The U is unity, that there's a quality of unity that's inherent in existence, and that we should embrace that unity in our communion, in our worship. And the S is service, that we should take that experience of unity out into the world with a quality of compassion and wisdom. And the last T is for transparency, that we should be honest, we should be accountable, and that we should allow people, if you will, into the deepest places of our own soul. And I just want to thank each of you for allowing me on the program today to share a little bit of this.
Teamwork, respect, unity, service, transparency. Wow.
Trust.
Thank
and if we
you.
Did
trust.
That, by the way, no matter what the labels, if we did that, Taliban no longer would be the Taliban. You know, the jihadists would no longer be the jihadists because they would trust. And if they trust, then all those walls, the group of Urantians just got back from Israel, that great wall that's around Jerusalem. What is that supposed to do? I mean, how silly of us, these walls that we've created.
I know.
It's about trust.
You know, and that is the essence of Jesus' teachings, right? I'm reminded of what the authors of Part 4 tell us, and that is, you know, great things happen not only because we believed in Jesus, they believed in Jesus, but because Jesus believed in them. And that's just invaluable to me. We have a caller from area code 415 who's been holding on for a while, and I think that's probably somebody you know, Karna. I know 415ers. Yeah, I know you do. Area code 415, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen. Gar Jameson.
This is Jerry Lane from Mill Valley, so... Yeah, we're here in the Bay Area.
Hi, Jerry.
I've really been enjoying Mr. Jameson's talking. I've just been thrilled by it. I've been a longtime student of the Urantia book, and it's just I haven't had that much association with the National Foundation, so it's wonderful to hear about all their outreach through across the world.
Thanks, Jerry.
It is wonderful.
Mill Valley's a beautiful place. You know, I took my kids and I took some of their friends last year to Jack Kornfield's retreat center there at Spirit Rock. You're familiar with that?
Oh, yeah, very much. Haven't been out there for a while, but I used to just go there without fail. He had some wonderful cooking there.
Oh,
wonderful
yes.
Buddhist chow to eat, you know.
Absolutely. Great vegetarian food, but what a wonderful thing for us as readers of this revelation to be able to walk into a Buddhist retreat center and feel perfectly at home. And
yes, I was just happy to be associated with the Zen community here at Green Gulch.
Mm-hmm, yes.
Every for about 10 years, every Sunday I get up about 5 o'clock and we go out and make a 16 dozen muffins. for these. Then there's always a Buddhist teacher there at 10 o'clock Sunday, and afterwards they have some tea and muffins, so it was fun making 196 muffins for the gathering there. So I encourage anybody who's in Marin County to go out and visit the Zen Center at Green Gulch, right on the ocean.
It's a beautiful place. There was a wonderful Buddhist teacher who I'm inspired by, D.T. Suzuki, who taught at the University of Hawaii, and kind of a diminutive Japanese man, and he would walk into his class the first day of class, and he would look around with this kind of scowl on his face. And then he would slap his hands or clap his hands as loud as possible. And he would say, "Wake up! Wake up! This is Buddhism. You wake up, you Buddhist."
I love technique.
If you wanted to sum the Arantia book, it's a wake-up call.
Yeah, it's the something that I ran into about 30 years or so ago, and we've had a study group here. Do you know Byron Belitzos?
Very well.
Sure.
Yeah,
good
Byron
friend.
And I kind of alternate back and forth here with a study group on Sunday now. Mm-hmm. And then we're both in something called the Teaching Mission, which mm-hmm. I guess you're aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that we've been involved in for a long time, and it's really thrilling just to be part of that. And I suppose your listeners all know there's a way of if they want to, I don't know, I'm going to do a plug here, but there, Byron has something called evolvingsouls.org, which is a nice website that tunes mm-hmm. a lot of people into the Teaching Mission.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as I say, there's many ways in which people have touched the elephant, and the book is very clear about the importance of auto-revelation.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
Whatever draws us closer to the Father, the Divine Mother, you know, it's a blessing, and so cannot be argued against. Right.
Uh-huh. It's something I was wondering about the Byron. I've been so involved over the years in the Teaching Mission. I'm not that familiar with the national organization of you know, the Rancho folks.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering about just the foundation's attitude towards the Teaching Mission. I guess it's kind of up and down, or I'm not sure exactly what it is.
Well, we don't, you know, as Paula said earlier, what's important for us is not to be interpreters. And it goes back to the statement on values. What's important for us is to respect one another. And so can we create a culture of respect? My wife and I started a free clinic here in Southern Nevada. We use the same acronym, TRUST, and we call it a culture of caring. And so can we be caring enough, can we be respectful enough to embrace the infinite value of each and every personality, no matter what their sect, no matter what their religion, no matter what their perspective? We may not always agree on the cognitive level, but at the level of soul, we recognize and we embrace each other as brothers and sisters.
There you go. Beautiful.
I think you bring up a very important point there, Gard, and that is the idea of, you know, what we can understand is that this could be, you know, auto-revelation for a lot of folks. We don't have to make any determination, you know, tell people what they are experiencing or not, but we do know that under the rubric of auto-revelation or their own spirit leading, that they may be getting their own adjuster communication and understanding it differently.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'd like to thank our caller, Jerry, from Mill Valley. I invite you to hang on as long as you like, Jerry. And, Mo, I'd like to hear your take on this, too, if you want to jump in. Are you up for that?
Well, I think Gard did a great job on that topic.
He did.
Well, it's important, and we've said many times at your Ranch Foundation, it's important for us, it's important for the fellowship, it's important for any organization not to come off as interpreters. People
right.
are tired of the College of Cardinals trying to tell them mm-hmm. how to think and how to believe and how to act.
Wow.
And so it's time for us to really honor and respect the dignity of personality wherever we find it.
Yeah.
I think Jesus said that we tend to become intolerant judges of orthodoxy. And that's one of the things that we need to, you know, beware of. Because we don't, at least my personal passion, one of them has been that I sure would not want to see the Arantia movement become yet another religion of authority. When Jesus held up so highly the religion of the Spirit, the religion of original personal spiritual experience, and that each one of us can come to the Heavenly Father in our own way. We don't have to do it the way that somebody else says. We can come, and you're speaking on contemplative prayer, and centering prayer is a perfect example of that, Gard, you know. It may not work for everybody, but the point is, and I think the overriding point of it is, to take time to have a relationship with God,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, you can't have a relationship with anybody you don't take time to have a relationship with. So.
Yeah, you want to know God's will? Well, hang out with God for a little bit.
Hang out with him. It's like Jesus said, I'm going to go have a little talk with my heavenly
yeah.
Father.
Let
yeah.
the old man speak to you for a moment or two.
Right.
You know,
I have a son. I have a son who's 24, and it's not so easy these days. But you know, he's coming around, and there's a recognition. And I've told him, I said, I'm just an advisor now, and that's who God is. He's our compassionate advisor. He's always there, never imposing himself, herself upon our personality, but always there and ready to give us a word of advice and the encouragement of his compassion if we would but just take the time and make that appointment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know,
he's
Paul,
always waiting for us, isn't he?
Yeah. Go ahead, Mo.
Well, I had this conversation with somebody the other day who was saying that...
And Mo, let me interrupt for a second. You need to get somehow closer to your mic or something. We've gotten some comments that you're hard to hear.
Can you hear me
we
now?
We say that at your ranch foundation too.
Speak up, Mo.
Can you hear me now?
That's
yeah,
better, Mo.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. So I was talking to a gentleman the other day, a leader in the Urantia movement, and we were talking about church. And he said, "Well, I don't really like to go to church, but my wife loves it, so I go to mm-hmm. church with her." And I like what you all were saying. It's however you find God. If you have a Heavenly Father in your heart, then you have the fruits of the Spirit in your life. The form is really not the relevant piece. It's mm-hmm. the substance that's the relevant piece.
Mm-hmm.
So true. I think we all know somebody, too, Gard. I'm sure you do. I know we all do. Who is just so deeply kind and loving and has such a heart of gold. And, you know, they're not really interested in reading the Urantia book. They're not opposed to it. They're not hungry for a lot of, you know, theological knowledge or information, even philosophy. They're not hungry for that. But they, in their heart, they so live the teachings. And you realize, I mean, at least I have, my own husband is like this. You know, he comes to study group and he listens with us and he reads. He doesn't get deeply engaged in the conversation. He takes it all in. He tells me afterwards, I love hearing Mo speak. I love hearing what Andre has to say. I really like Jim Downs. You know, he always gives me this feedback. But he's not so hungry for those teachings as like I was or maybe mm-hmm. some of you were. He's happy either way. And we all know somebody like that, that they're there. They're already there. In their heart, they're right with God.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a rich spiritual experience. And we don't need to fix them. You know what I mean? I think this is the problem with fundamentalism in a way, and it cuts across all boundaries. We think we need to fix each other. We don't.
Well, what we appreciate, especially in the interfaith world, is that everything is scaffolding.
Yeah.
And if you think about yeah. that image of scaffolding, what is it about? It's about building something. It's about building a soul. And every tradition has scaffolding. You know, some of us on the line happen to think that the Urantia book is a quality of scaffolding that's exquisite. But we cannot deny the scaffolding of other traditions and the appreciation of that scaffolding as it is building those souls. So once you take that heart of gratitude into those relationships, it's just delicious. I mean, I will tell you, in the interfaith world, the Urantia book has received great welcome because people have realized and perceived that we're not there to convert anybody, that this is a book that represents scaffolding for us that's really transformed our lives, but we're not there to beat anybody over the head with it. And so that is really, the journey forward is to realize mm-hmm. that it's about the scaffolding. And the question is, what kind of scaffolding do you have on your life right now? The Urantia book may be one piece of it, but do you have that contemplative discipline in your life? Are you willing to take that 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the evening? And I keep coming back to this. Again, as Thomas says, anything less than a contemplative perspective on life is an almost certain program for unhappiness. Mm-hmm. And so when we begin to see that, we begin to say, oh, yes, I want door number two. I want the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, and peace. I don't want to continue every morning to get on that rack with panic disorders with a quality of anger and a lack of forgiveness. That's not any fun anymore. And that's why the transformation, Mo, is going to happen in these other traditions. People are going to realize that kind of sectarianism, that kind of brutality doesn't work. And people like John Stewart and Colbert are helping us to appreciate that through a quality of laughter. Not only, we don't even have to go to Afghanistan, we can actually go to the halls of Congress to see the kind of silliness that people engage in and realize that there's another way of being, and we all know that. The question is, do we have the courage to embrace that and to make the decision to every day, as Peter said, neglect not your daily worship.
Well, and one of the things that I find really fascinating about the study of religion as a phenomenon, as a personal phenomenon, is that there are several traditions throughout the world of religious who really truly value ethical treatment of our fellows. Being devoted to high principles, being devoted to value systems and ways of let's say, welcoming strangers or guests into your village or into your town or into your community. You know, the way you deal with widows and orphans as a society, how you deal with people who are oppressed or who are disabled in some way. There are all of these things that are really respectable about other traditions and religions that the Western mindset has, or Western culture has been sort of to squelch those ideals in favor of a dogmatic presentation of something different.
Yeah. Well, it was at the 1893 Parliament of World Religions in the Palmer House where Paula and I were privileged to be there in 1993 on the centennial. But at the 1893, all of the Protestant ministers, the fundamentalists, were thinking, well, we'll get these pagans over here and we'll convert them to the true way. Well, it was at that 1893 Parliament that a young Swami named Vivekananda got up and he spoke to his brothers and sisters of America. And with those words, everybody jumped to their feet, and for 5 minutes there was applause and appreciation. And it's that kind of vision, that kind of appreciation, that once our Protestant brothers and sisters, and there are many who do, but once they all begin to see that, they will get the same kind of understanding that Vivekananda had, which is God is love, and he's a universal quality of love, and it passes all the boundaries.
Yes. You know, I want to share a little story about myself, because when I was 28 years old, I lost my husband in a car accident, and I had two little children, a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I had had the Urantia book for 7 years at that point, or actually 8 years. And it was clearly the spiritual touchstone of my life. And I feel like I had a great relationship with God before I found it. It really showed me what a great relationship I had with my father. He was always my best friend. And I realized that the deeper I went into the Urantia teachings, it was such a wonderful affirmation for me. But I was praying one night while I was driving, and I was, you know, it brought about this event in my life brought about another deep level of searching my soul. And I was asking God, what do you want me to do? What is your will for me? What is your will? And I got back just one word, very clear, just love. And you know, and it was one of those things where then everything sort of just came in ultimate clarity. Like, okay, so sure, you know, what the world needs now, what the world needs most, what could I possibly do that would be more important than that? than to just love. So few people really experience it in their life, and I feel like I've been blessed because I have experienced that from humans in my life who just loved me.
Mm-hmm.
And what more important thing could I do besides that? It was a very simple admonition to just love.
Well, my observation of your life, Paula, is that you have been an apostle of love, and I just want to thank you for being that.
Well, thanks, Gardner. You know, you're right. You have to get back to that place almost every day, every single day.
Yeah, and then you have to go out into your communities. You have to go out into your communities, and you have to recognize that our community is our sacred brothers and sisters. Your rancher community is very important, but we have these others, and there are so many that are yearning and desperate. You know, when I teach my class, I have them read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which was about his experience in concentration camp. And then I have them write the most meaningful moment in their life where the sacred sort of stepped in. And what I will tell you...
That's a fabulous exercise. Wow.
Yeah, and it's a revelatory process for these kids, because as they begin to open up to their own biography, their own narrative, they begin to see something more to their lives than the tragedy that they've experienced. And I will tell you, 75% of them have experienced the deepest forms of tragedy that one could imagine in a lifetime. I had a student last semester who came to me. He was a captain, Iraq vet, and he came to me and he said, "We need your clinic." I said, "You guys have the VA." He said, No. "The VA is not working out very well. We go in there, they diagnose us as PTSD, and our careers are over. And then they put us on OxyContin, and we are drug addicted." And he said, "In the last 6 months, Professor Jameson, six of my men have put a pistol to their head. 22 every day. Imagine this day, there will be 22 vets that will put a gun to their head and commit suicide." Well, our approach to this kind of mental health dysfunction or difficulty, excuse my French, it's ass backwards.
Okay.
It is a medical model which has proven not to work. And the CVSs and the Walgreens are getting rich on it, and it just doesn't work. And what the neuroscientists, like Buddha's Brain, Rick Hansen, are showing is that if we can begin to bring a contemplative dimension to consciousness, then all of those opiates, all of those painkillers, all of those things which we get addicted to are absolutely not necessary. In fact, they are detrimental to our well-being and our health care. So, again, the book very clearly says to a body and a mind and a spirit of balanced equilibrium, balanced energies, a maximum of light can be imparted. And so can we take responsibility for our emotional states? Can we take responsibility for our disease? Can we begin to look beyond the boundaries of Walgreens and CVS to a higher form of prescription? That to me is the challenge of this moment. And I think people are beginning to do it. Very exciting. I had one of my students, you know, as a result of the class, she came up to me and she said, "You know, I wanted to teach you for that Buddhist teaching on fellowship, on hanging out with good people." I said, "Why?" She said, "2 weeks ago, friends of mine invited me onto Lake Mead, and we were going to go onto the biggest and most wonderful boat. It was a luxury boat. But I began to realize that these weren't the kind of people I wanted to hang out with, whose values I embraced. Long story short, that night the boat hit one of our rock walls and everybody was killed except for the captain." And it's that simple, it's that practical, that we have to learn how, if you will, to embrace a new quality of value, truth, beauty, goodness. And when we do that, we are transformed in the process. And it's just such a joy and honor to be a teacher, because I get to see these students through the course of a semester, and I tell them, all I'm really doing this semester is kind of showing you that there's a pathway from door number one to door number two, and that is your birthright. And if you get that message, then you've got my class. And I would say about 60 to 70% of them get that message. The rest just need a credit in order to graduate, but it's all good, and it's wonderful to see that quality of transformation.
How did you get to where you are now in terms of teaching at the university and what you're teaching. What was your path to getting there yourself?
Well, I used to I tell people that I was a kind of a vampire. After spending 10 hours of being a CPA during the day, I would come out at night and put on my cloak, and I would go to the university, and I would teach Eastern religion and Western religions at the night school. And one day I got a call from the head of continuing education, and she said, you know, we've lost our professor of Asian traditions. Would you be willing to teach Asian philosophy? Well, like a fish to a large piece of bait, I said, absolutely. And so it's, again, been the privilege to teach Indian and Chinese philosophy as well as the history of Western philosophy to these students. And it's kind of fun because Thursday night we call it Red Vine Night, and I give them a little video. So, for instance, when I'm teaching the Stoics, I show them a little clip from The Gladiator, and it's that passage where Marcus Aurelius, the great Roman philosopher, Stoic philosopher, turns to Maximus, the great gladiator, and says, I need you to be the new emperor. And Maximus says, well, what about your son Commodus? And Marcus Aurelius, you may remember the line, says, he cannot rule. He must not rule. He is not a moral man. And yet, how little of that philosophy has sunk into our own consciousness.
Oh, boy.
And so when we begin to see these larger pictures, we begin to realize we're in a moment of transition. Philosophy calls it postmodernism. The Urantia book says in the first few lines of the book, the first few words, in the minds of mortals there is great confusion. Well, welcome to postmodernism. That is what we're in, and that's what I tell my students. We're in a very confused state right now. Lots of different
confusion.
Directions. Great confusion. And so what we try to do is get a little bit of clarity around the elephant. And then I just must mention my dear wife, who is my inspiration. I've been married to for 32 years and been in love with for 47 years. And she's just such a wonderful soul. But she was the inspiration behind starting what we call Volunteers in Medicine of Southern Nevada. And last year we saw 6,000 patient visits. We're the medical home for 2,700 families. And these are people who do not have access to medical care, to mental health. And we call it a culture of caring. It's a place which imbibes the teachings of the Urantia book without explicitly putting the Urantia book into the faces of the people that walk through our door, because they don't need it. What they need is hope and health care. And so she has been such a beautiful example of how you bring this revelation, which she loves with all of her heart, out into the world and touch the lives of others. The other piece which she does, which is so beautiful, is she opened a clinic at Juvenile Justice where these young girls come in and they have been sex trafficked. And she had one 2 weeks ago who was 15 years old. And Florence said, I saw you last year. What are you doing back here? And the young girl said, I have great news for you. You remember last year when I was 14, I told you that my younger sister was sort of emulating me and wanting to fall in the track of prostitution and she was going to follow the same pathway. Well, she's not doing it, and I'm not doing it. And I want to tell you, as a result of your conversation with me last year, I am following my dream. I want to be a model, and I want to do well in the world, and I am no longer prostituting, and the only reason I'm back here was I was out past curfew. I broke my parole. But everything is just wonderful. Thank you very much, Dr. Jameson. So my wife is my inspiration in this kind of work, and the two of us are trying, if you will, to bring the Urantia book into our backyard, into our community. We're doing a lot of work around collective impact, around the community with nonprofits. We're bringing a new vision of how trust can really transform a community, and we're focusing right now in the downtown area with the downtown at-risk schools, bringing in, if you will, healthcare, bringing in the environmental concerns, bringing in the arts and culture. So our Performing Arts Center is inviting these kids to the Performing Arts Center to see ballet, to see symphony. Our environmental people are bringing community gardens to their schools and teaching them about the value of the earth. Our healthcare people are bringing healthcare, access to healthcare, to their families and to them. So it's just a lovely new vision, and it's the vision of the Supreme, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But it's enfleshed. And what we as Urantia book students need to do is to take this candle out from underneath the bushel, and we need to be able to begin to bring a brighter light to our own backyards, to our communities, and really touch people where they are. And in time, that quality of love will open them to a new quality of perspective, which will allow them to say, the Muslims are, just as Mahatma Gandhi said, I'm a Muslim, I'm a Hindu, I'm a Christian, I'm a Jew, I'm a Taoist, right? Can we say that? And
yes.
Can we mean it? The labels are just labels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I am all of these things and so much more. I am
so much more. I'm a child of God. And he said it with such humor.
Yeah.
And he could look in the eye of the person who shot him and say, glory to God, as he was being murdered.
Mm.
And so that quality of consciousness, that's what the world's waiting for, and that's what Jesus encourages each of us. And each of you are, if you will, representative of that quality of consciousness. And so thank you.
Well, Gard, how did you begin to get interested in interfaith?
The
interfaith movement. Yeah.
Well, I did my degree in comparative religion, and that is really what got me started. And then I spent some time in Saudi Arabia, and I got to know Muslims, and I got to know that they weren't problematic. They were wonderful people. Used to go down to the mosque.
How did you happen to be in Saudi?
I was in Saudi doing work with a contractor, and I was there for a period of time, and it was a wonderful experience. And when they would go play bridge, I would go to the mosque, and I would go listen to stories of Muhammad. And what I saw was a quality of compassion and love and wisdom, and it caused me to have a deep respect. And then I had the privilege of going to India from there and meeting R.S. Johann, who I think Paula is familiar with, and I know Mo knows about, a wonderful Urantia book reader in India. And he introduced me to Sufis and to Jains and to all kinds of wonderful people. And it was just transformative. It was just lovely. Nietzsche once said, I can only respect a God that dances. And what I've experienced in the Urantia movement and within the interfaith movement is a God who dances and a God who laughs and a God who sings.
So true. So would you say that you took comparative religions because you were seeking?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And many of my professors were not happy with me because my papers would reflect that quality of seeking. And a little less scholarship and a little more seeking. So
Where were you studying?
I was at Stanford University. I had one professor in the philosophy of religion, imagine this, who had me rewrite a paper 7 times. And each time he would call me into his office and he said, Jameson, you don't get it. And the assignment, imagine this, was to basically corroborate that Jesus was an unethical person.
Oh.
And each time I would come back and say, au contraire. Jesus was the most ethical person that ever walked the face of the planet. And each time he would call me into his office, and finally the 7th time he called me into his office, he said, Jameson, I'm going to pass you, but you're wrong.
He was the model of that. Similar experiences for me, Gard. I also studied comparative religions academically. But having been raised with the Urantia book, I wasn't really seeking to find answers for myself. I was really there wanting to find out really sincerely what the rest of the world thought, believed in, how they worshipped, etc. Well, that really wasn't the focus of most of my religion courses academically. You know, they were really much more interested in a very dry assessment.
Yeah, it's a study
of religion.
A study about religion rather than a study of religion.
Exactly.
So
I got a lot of papers returned as well.
Yeah, but that's okay. That's all right. My father, when we graduated, there were, if you will, 60 or 70 in psychology, and there were 110 in physics, and there were 4 of us in religion. And my father turned to my mother. He said, I believe I just flushed a lot of tuition down the toilet.
Oh, boy.
No way.
And yet, it was the only thing I really could have done at the moment.
And so, studying religion, obviously, you got into accounting.
Yes. Well, Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
Yeah, I wonder how that happened.
Dietrich Bonhoeffer is a lovely, lovely person. He was a Christian theologian who actually was martyred during the Second World War as a result of his Christian beliefs, and he worked against Nazism during the war, and he has a wonderful book called The Cost of Discipleship, and in there he says it's imperative that every Christian carry the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other hand. In other words, that we carry those ideals with us at all times, but we also carry a quality of practical engagement. And so for me, my tent making became becoming a CPA. So during the day, I would be out there counting beans. Literally, I did the audit on Hillsboro coffee and got high on just the smell in the warehouses. But during the night, I would go back to Berkeley, and we would be putting out radio broadcasts all over the planet proclaiming the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. And it was a wonderful combination of a Urantia book in one hand and the newspaper in the other hand.
Again, Jesus was not opposed to any occupation that was honest, and you know, he was in fact a tent maker and a boat builder and a fisherman and a carpenter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So a coffee maker, coffee bean counter becomes friends with the coffee bean counter
yeah.
becomes friends with a tea manufacturer.
Isn't that awesome?
How did that happen?
A tea manufacturer. Wow, that was a wonderful evolution. I like that word, evolution. And it was a wonderful evolution. And so Mo and I became familiar when we were involved with what was called then the Urantia Brotherhood. We were both on the executive committee. We both had a fabulous experience there. And it was a transformative moment for all of us. And then when I was asked to become a trustee, I was a little reluctant and a little nervous about that transition. And I told my friends, which he may be upset with me for having said this, but I said, a much better person for you would be Mo Siegel. And finally they came back and they said, well, we want to take both of you, and we want to ask both of you to become trustees. And when that happened, I actually saw an opportunity for, if you will, a bit of a cultural shift in our community, a bit of an opportunity to open up, if you will, the culture of the foundation to a more contemplative appreciation. And that indeed has been what's been transpiring over the last several years. And Mo and I often look down at our ankles and we remark tethered, and so we are. And I suspect we'll be tethered all the way to paradise. And he's a dear friend, and he's somebody, again, as we say, if I was in the trenches, I would want Mo Siegel covering my back, because he's a good man.
Well, I
wonderful.
Agree with that wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
Well, that's a wonderful segue to looking at, you know, what you're doing in Urantia Foundation. There's two questions that I have, and one is, you know, what are some of the immediate things that you regard as important things that you are doing in Urantia Foundation? Maybe important's the wrong word, but what do you regard as priorities? And secondly, with regard to the revelation as a whole, why do you think we have this revelation now? There's all kinds of current views, some that say that, you know, we're in some kind of a philosophical crisis. Some say that we're just at an evolutionary juncture where we needed it. So would you mind tackling that?
Sure. Well, the first question, Andre, great question. You know, I think the really important things that are going on right now is a dissemination of the revelation. So the 14 translations, the Chinese translation that's coming on stream, the Japanese translation that's coming on stream shortly, all of these translations, we hope, and this was Richard Keeler's, and I'll tip the hat to him, vision that at some point in the not-too-distant future, over 80% of the world's population will have access to the fifth epical revelation. And I think before all of us leave the planet, and hopefully that will be a long while from now, but before we leave the planet, we will be able to say that, and that we will be able to say that there's a quality translation. And so the standard reference text, which is a committee that basically ensures that we've got a quality text, which was a collaboration of all the communities, which is a wonderful thing. So we have, if you will, wonderful work going on with the book. And Mo, as you know, is the consummate marketer, and he is always looking at how, in a world where bookstores are dying, in a world where people are less and less reading books, they're actually more and more texting and doing mobile internet, how do we translate, if you will, the book into those mediums so that we can appeal to Millennium X and the generations that are coming up in a palpable way? So that's just wonderful, wonderful work that's going on. The other leg, I would say, Andre, is education. And so George DuPont and Dorothy Elders have done a wonderful job in terms of getting the Urantia Book Internet School up and running, UBIS, which anybody that's interested, go to ubis.org through the Urantia Foundation site or through the, I think you can get through the fellowship site as well. And a wonderful course is being taught, and anywhere you are on the planet, you can have access to those courses. And so we see bringing back, if you will, in-depth studies at Urantia Foundation. We have totally remodeled Urantia Foundation. It is just pristine, and I tip my hat to Jennifer Siegel on that one. She has been
too.
Just such an angel in terms of getting those guys in there and really moving the walls and creating a place where people will be excited to come and learn about the Fifth Epoch Revelation, do in-depth study. This November, Marta Elders is going to do a seminar on soul, which is going to rock, because Marta Elders rocks, and she's a wonderful soul. And so it's exciting. So education and the book, these are the primary tasks. And again, just the blocking and tackling every day of people who are interested in the Urantia book and getting them out to study groups. That's the new study group portal is a wonderful thing, and encouraging them to learn about the Urantia book. So, and the second piece, Andre, is...
Yes,
the Urantia book is come at just the opportune time, and I will want to say that the timing on it. I'm a student of the secondary sources, and it was actually in the 80s that I actually shared with Matthew Block a few quotes, and he was working at the fellowship or the brotherhood then, and a few quotes from a book, and I said, "This looks like Marantia Moda," and he started to vibrate and get excited. And as we know, Matthew Block has done wonderful work on finding the secondary sources. And so some of those secondary sources, the primary ones that I'm interested in, are the ones who really have sort of unpacked and amplified the appreciation of personality. Because personality is the supreme revelation of God to the universe, and in my opinion, it's the supreme revelation of the revelation, the idea of personality and the integrity of personality. And so the personalists as a school, back on the East Coast, really lit the fire and really brought together a lot of different strands of philosophy to appreciate personality. So two things, right? One is personality, and the other was Edwin Hubble, and his discoveries about the universe. Those were the two things that precipitated the revelator saying, the time is now. And the time is now because they had just experienced, just witnessed the First World War. And they were anticipating and knew that what was coming was the Second World War. And what we have with the advent of nuclear weaponry, and I wrote my first book on this, the advent of nuclear weaponry is we have a tool, right, which has perhaps peaceful purposes, but which could be used to destroy the world of the cross, the world of Jesus' seventh bestowal. And so this is the moment, and the call is to each and every one of us to take seriously this moment, because, again, in the minds of mortals there's great confusion philosophically, scientifically, and religiously. We just had Richard Dawkins, who wrote The God Delusion, at our university giving a speech on The God Delusion. And what I appreciate is there is so much confusion, and my students, right, they often say, well, no, I don't believe in God. And I always say to them, tell me about the God you don't believe in, because I probably don't believe in that one either.
Right.
And so we have a wonderful conversation about how it is that we, how we engage, if you will, our images and how our images shape us.
Yeah.
So this is the moment, and that's why we have the book right now. I often ask the question, why Jesus then? Why didn't Jesus come now? Or why didn't Jesus come a few hundred years later when there was a little more, perhaps, enlightenment? But I think he came at a turning point, which I call the classical moment, where individuality was being affirmed in the Western culture. And with the advent of individuality came the appreciation of relationships. And so what Crystalline spoke of earlier, the golden rule, the ethic, and all the great world's religions, that was really coming into the consciousness of people at that moment. So it was an opportune time to present a vision of possibilities. And so that's exactly what the Master did. He provided that vision of possibilities and did it with such grace and integrity.
And we probably wouldn't be where we are, or not probably wouldn't, but we definitely wouldn't be where we are now in terms of progress and civilization had he not been here 2,000 years ago.
Had we not
had the pouring out of the spirit of truth and the presentation of the thought adjusters, we wouldn't have advanced as much as we have in the last 2,000 years.
Yes,
so
yes,
true.
Absolutely.
You mentioned earlier those first three chakras. I really love that, and I think they represent, to a large degree, the seven adjutant mind spirits. I think they correlate very nicely.
Mm-hmm,
and, you know, it's interesting that, you know, that we know we're given seven epochs, basic epochs of evolution, and each one is characterized by an epical revelation. And we had those first three revelations. Those correlate pretty nicely to those chakras, too, and those adjutants. And then the fourth, of course, was Jesus, and he was the revelation of the heart and the revelation
heart,
of God's love.
Mm-hmm.
And if ever there was an ambassador from the other realm to reveal God to us, it's Jesus. No matter what you believe about him, you'd have to admit that there's never been anyone who lived on the planet who revealed God's love to that degree. And, you know, certainly, and as Crystalline pointed out, we know that everything changed then with the outpouring of the spirit of truth and the outpouring of thought adjusters, and just everything stepped up. And so, you know, here we are now with the fifth revelation, and it clarifies all the other four, and especially that fourth one. It really hones in on that. It gives us back the fullness of that revelation, even past, present, and future of that, you know, of that being Jesus, Michael, Christ Michael. And now we're in the fifth, which, you know, it's a book, obviously, that we tell each other about in the age of communication. I love that. I love that. It's just so apropos to me. It's the throat, about the throat, what we're communicating, what we're telling each other, you know, the information that we're spreading.
Yes, and, well, we're so privileged to be alive right now. We're so privileged to be on the planet of the cross, the planet of our Master. And we're so privileged to have one another. I greatly value the quality of my relationships with each of the three of you and with every member in this community. And the older I get, the more I appreciate Jesus' words, who are my brother and sister, and the recognition that we're on this great adventure. But we've been given the privilege of starting on the world of the cross. Wow, wow, what an adventure. What a wild adventure. And
what a place to be from.
What a quality of joy is possible here. And so can we begin to manifest that quality of joy? That's the question.
Well, we're in that rip-roaring transition right now. They talk about it, the cyclonic era. You know, I mean, and they describe it in terms that really do describe it. I mean, it's quite amazing. And they say we won't settle down complacently for 1,000 years. Do you think we'll
quivering on the brink?
Yeah, quivering on the brink. Do you think we'll see some suddenlies as we go forward here where people, you know, like great epiphanies, maybe human epiphanies, where we suddenly reach a
realization? To me, the Internet has been a suddenly.
Oh, well, that's true. Good point.
You know, you think about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we didn't even really, we couldn't even really conceive of the possibilities of change that happened that quickly in terms of worldwide communication, a worldwide web of communication and connection to anybody else on a computer.
I
mean,
so true. So true.
And you think about the conflict within the movement about the mode of transmitting the book to new readers, mm-hmm. and the kinds of conflicts that we had 30, 40 years ago about dissemination. Well, we wouldn't have even been arguing about that if we had known that 20 years later it would be available free on the internet to anybody in the world.
May I ask a favor of the three of you lovely people?
Of course.
Please.
Sure.
We are having today a celebration of our 750 volunteers at our clinic.
Mm.
And I've just gotten a sign from my wife, it's time to go.
Oh.
So my question is, and you know when it comes to marriage, right? Paula, you understand this.
Yeah,
that the best thing a husband can say is, yes, dear.
I'm on my way.
And so I've learned this from Mo. I've learned it from many people. So I just want to ask the question, would you be willing to speak amongst yourselves for a moment or two until the end of this?
We're grateful for the time you were able to give us.
Absolutely.
Well, I love each of you, and I embrace each
love
of you,
you
and I embrace each of the listeners, and just thank you for the privilege of being with you.
And one last thing, Gard, I'd like to invite you back on to talk about your the books that you've authored in the last couple
mm-hmm.
of years.
Mm. We didn't even touch on
mythology. We didn't even get there. So you have to promise to come back if you're leaving us 10 minutes early.
Well, I will leave you with one last thought. Joseph Campbell said, your religion is my mythology, right?
Uh-huh.
And what we appreciate is that even the Urantia book, as it speaks of itself as scaffolding, is, if you understand the word, a mythology.
Yes, an updated mythology.
It's an
mm-hmm.
upstated mythology. And when you understand the context of that word and you understand the depth of that word, you begin to open your heart and your mind to all of the different perspectives on the planet, and you begin to realize what a wonderful life and opportunity to ride the back of this elephant.
Indeed.
Yep, there you
well,
go.
Thank you
well,
so
thank
much
you.
For being
God,
with us
God
today.
Bless. God bless.
God bless.
Talk to you soon. Okay,
generous,
bye-bye.
Generous with your
okay.
time. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well,
so,
wasn't that fun? To have
wonderful.
Your good friend Gard on and Mo and to hear from them both at the same time, but especially Gard, what a wealth of information Gard is. And you can see,
yeah.
wouldn't you just...
We barely scratched the surface
I know.
Of what we could be talking about with Gard.
I'd love to be in his class.
One of the things
I would love
I'd
to
love...
take one of his
well,
ahead,
one
people.
Of the things I would love to do is to have Gard and Peter and Mo and Frank Kaufman and some of the other guests we've had on, all on at the same time.
Oh, that would be interesting.
Yeah.
That would be
I
a
kick. I think
check.
We could have a wonderful panel discussion at some point if we, you know, it would take a little bit of arranging, but I think that would be wonderful. You know, in our last few minutes here, because we're down to our last 7 minutes, I'm wondering, one thing that strikes me as encapsulating a lot of what Gard spoke about was the quote that talks about Jesus' unbroken communion, paper 196. I already posted it on the board in pieces, but we could certainly just quickly go through that and then maybe just cover what we've got coming up next week.
Because next week is Danyon Brinkley, who is a very, very popular best-selling author. Clinically died twice and came back with very important things to say, and I've heard Danyon speak a couple of times, and that's going to be a great show. Danyon will be with us for an hour next week, and we'll do some life after death prior to his coming on. So next week's show is all about life after death, so spread the word. It's going to be a great show, and if there's anybody you know that's grieving, I think they'll really love this show. It'll be an important
show.
And
we'd like to continue that on for the following week.
Yeah, that'd be great. We're going to be doing. We're going to be presenting the Urantia book at a conference designed wholly for people who help the dying, and so it's kind of a kickoff.
Where
that.
Is
That's
that?
Going to happen in May. It's in Portland, Oregon. The aftermath.
And what's the date of that conference?
It's the end of, actually, it's the very first weekend in June. So,
and what's
Portland,
the name
Oregon,
of it?
The Afterlife Conference, I believe. Joanne has been doing all the details. Joanne's my assistant.
What
and,
a great topic for a conference.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And she had this great idea, which I just thought was wonderful. She said, wouldn't it be wonderful if the entire Urantia movement could come together and create an event around that and invite everybody to come? I thought, wow,
yeah.
What a great idea. What a great collaborative effort that would be, because really there's nothing that speaks more to life after death or the afterlife than the Urantia book does. So.
Mm-hmm. That's
so
wonderful.
We're down to the last 5 minutes. If you want to share anything from Paper 96, we ought to get on it.
Yes.
Yeah, so Paper 196, the introductory section, paragraph 10, that's page 2088 for those of you that have your books in front of you, and let's go. Jesus brought to God as a man of the realm the greatest of all offerings, the consecration and dedication of his own will to the majestic service of doing the divine will. Jesus always and consistently interpreted religion wholly in terms of the Father's will. When you study the career of the Master as concerns prayer or any other feature of the religious life, look not so much for what he taught as for what he did. Jesus never prayed as a religious duty. To him, prayer was a sincere expression of spiritual attitude, a declaration of soul loyalty, a recital of personal devotion, an expression of thanksgiving, an avoidance of emotional tension, a prevention of conflict, an exaltation of intellection, an ennoblement of desire, a vindication of moral decision, an enrichment of thought, an invigoration of higher inclinations, a consecration of impulse, a clarification of viewpoint, a declaration of faith, a transcendental surrender of will, a sublime assertion of confidence, a revelation of courage, the proclamation of discovery, a confession of supreme devotion, the validation of consecration for the adjustment of difficulties, and the mighty mobilization of the combined soul powers to withstand all human tendencies towards selfishness, evil, and sin. He lived just such a life of prayerful consecration to the doing of the Father's will, and ended his life triumphantly with just such a prayer. The secret of his unparalleled religious life was the consciousness of the presence of God, and he attained it by intelligent prayer and sincere worship, unbroken communion with God, and not by leadings, voices, visions, or extraordinary religious practices.
Well, there you go. Unbroken communion with God. So we'll take that word, and with Gard's admonition to spend 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes at night in silent contemplation of the Creator in his presence. Jesus always said, you do well to know about the fact of God, but you would do better to feel his presence.
Yeah.
So.
The revelation of personality that we have in the Urantia book is so helpful in actually learning how to have a relationship
right
with the divine.
Exactly. And I just want to say to caller 760, I'm sorry we didn't get you on the air. We just ran out of time, but please do call back next week even, and we'll get you on. And to all of our listeners, thanks for listening. Glad you joined us. Hope you enjoyed the show with Gard. We sure did. And we'll be back next week with Daniel Brinkley.
It'll be a great show, so tune in, same time, same station.
All about life after death. And until next we meet, have a wonderful week. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
God bless.
Thank you, my co-host. It was a blast with Garden Mo.
Yeah. Couldn't be better.
All right.
Thanks, guys.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.